Today in Rebels. The corporate gay elite takes on politics, the homophobia of the far right, who the fuck was Pete Buttigieg, and much more. With Yasmin Air.
Okay, so today we are here with Yasmin Nair, a writer, activist, and academic. Yasmin is the co-founder of the Radical Queer Editorial Collective Against Equality and the policy director of the Chicago Queer Radical Collective Gender Just. Her work has appeared in a number of left publications, and she's also a writer and editor at large at Current Affairs, and you can find her at yasminnair.com or at Nair Yasmin. On Twitter. Hi, Yasmin, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, it's such a pleasure to see your faces as well. Thank you so much, I'm really honored. Thank you so much.
So we were hoping that to get started, maybe you could give us a little spiel of queer politics from over the sort of past 30 years. Maybe a big ask, but just sort of like a run through as you've experienced it.
sure, absolutely. So over the last 30 years, right, so this is 2020, so we're talking, yeah, okay. I came of age, I guess, as a sort of a queer leftist sometime, even before the whole gay marriage fracas began. And I've been thinking a lot about what that history is about in terms of politically and what it means for queer people. So I think the most significant shift in the last 30 odd years has, of course, been the shifts brought about by the gay marriage fight. And before that, there was a lot of people let me put it this way. There's a certain version of queer history that tends to dominate cultural conversations and even political conversations. And the history, you know, goes something like this. As I've said before, it goes something like this. In the 1930s and 40s, at least just even going back to just that period, there was deep repression and gay people were hounded just for being gay. And then the 60s came along and the 70s, there was free love. And then the 80s brought about AIDS and wasn't that horrible. And then gay people realized that sex is bad. And then they decided marriage would help everything and boom. And now gay people are fine. Everything is fine, etc. So that's sort of the long kind of, that's the trajectory of queer life, I think, that people have in their imagination, and including most people, I think, even on the left who should know better. So that's the historical trajectory that has been painted for us. The reality is that, first of all, across the world, queerness is, of course, very complicated, and it has nothing to do actually with whom you fuck. That's one issue. But at least within places like the UK, many parts of Europe, and certainly, in the United States, queer history, I think the big event, of course, that galvanized a lot of things politically for queers in the United States, and I think in other places, was the AIDS epidemic. And that was this defining moment in many ways. And what you saw, and then in the 90s, so as we know, the AIDS epidemic was all about queers were the ones who having to take on the responsibility and the for themselves in terms of healthcare. So you have the 90s, you have this AIDS epidemic, you have a president who refuses to even acknowledge that it exists. You have many, many, many queer people, mostly gay men, dying of AIDS, their bodies not even being accepted by hospitals and so on. And then finally, because of extremely queer radical activism in the 90s, you get massive changes in big pharma and so on. What happens in the 90s, and this is so around the 90s is when we finally see major wins, right? So what happens in the 90s though, is that you get this community that is physically and politically exhausted Many of his members have actually even have died by then. And you get this political and cultural vacuum. And what you get in the 90s also is a steady rise of neoliberal politics, of course, which has been going on, which had been going on till about the 70s. But for gay people in particular, you know, the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, you know, period of high economic prosperity and so on. And you have a class of gays and lesbians who are now acquiring economic status and are more willing to talk about themselves, wanting to be more like other rich Americans, etc. But what you get is a conservative gay community coming to the rise and filling in that political void left by AIDS activism, in essence. And it doesn't help that a lot of the people who are involved in AIDS activism, like Michelangelo Signorile, for instance, are now also, for instance, big gay marriage advocates, etc. Right? So you get this political and cultural vacuum, and you have this rise also of the gay nonprofit industrial complex. So, and what happens there is that you had groups like what was once the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Now the NGLTF, which is now the task force now, was not exactly radical, but it was more in the spirit of the 60s, 70s, you know, sandal shod gay radical-ish, at least more progressive wing of the gay nonprofit world. But that group also became much more conservative. And you have the rise of the Human Rights Campaign, which is quite literally today, with about a $40 million operating budget, the most powerful gay organization in literally the world, right? So you have the Human Rights Campaign coming up. What you have essentially is gay money and a desire to make that money a part of America, you know, American cultural life and politics. What you have are a lot of wealthy gay men and women who feel that they deserve to be acknowledged as wealthy Americans, not just as gay Americans, right? So you have, I mean, there's all this, all these issues around class and economics and so on. So you have the rise of those nonprofits, and then you have the decision being made by the nonprofits that gay marriage is a critical cause. And you have 1994, you have the Hawaii, there's a court case, there's a lawsuit in Hawaii, which doesn't go well, but it does mobilize people. So it mobilizes a lot of powerful gay men and women. And you get this cultural shift gradually, towards gays and lesbians, where there is less stigma, but then the move is more also towards establishing gays and lesbians as good Americans and more culturally and politically acceptable Americans as well. And the radical portion of the gay movement is in the meantime static or withering, in some parts dead, etc. You know, and what happens then in the aughts, the 2003, 2005, 2008, all those critical moments where you have important pieces of gay legislation, you have also a fight around gay marriage, which becomes a fight about homophobes opposed to gays and lesbians, etc. So that's the cultural kind of division that's portrayed in the media, right? And then alongside that, you also get extremely conservative pushes in the gay community for things like hate crime legislation, inclusion of gays and lesbians in the military. Again, because in the United States, the divisions were so starkly drawn, and because there was for a long time a quote unquote homophobic far right that did actually, yes, admittedly, want to see us dead. Yes, absolutely. Because of that sort of strong cultural division, the problem was that the causes that the gay orgs, the nonprofit industrial complex, threw up were not recognized as being also deeply conservative and soul-shattering and so on, right? So hate crime legislation puts more people in jail because it extends prison sentences, for instance. Inclusion in the military just says that gays and lesbians have a right to go about killing people in the name of America, quote unquote, right? So, but at that time, the cultural conversation is about that polarization between a right wing and the gay people on the other side. So of course the left liberal, sort of the broad swathe of the left as it were, thinks, oh, this is awful. It's we're fighting against these people here on the right. We have to support gay people no matter what. So intellectually what that does is discursively, politically, is that it denudes the sort of the cultural discourse of any critical evaluative strategy, right, in terms of gay politics. People are too scared to actually say, you know what, actually, marriage, you know, feminists were too afraid to say out loud, we fought to not have to get married, right? Other people on the left were too afraid to say, why is it that gay marriage is about healthcare through marriage when we've been fighting for universal healthcare, as many radical queers had also fought for, right? So you get, I think essentially what happens in sort of the 90s and the early 2000s is this, because of the cultural polarization, people are unwilling to critique gay politics for what it really is, for what it was and what it is. And so now we're in this big mess because now we have COVID. And what we're realizing is, at least, and this is a very US specific context, so forgive me for that, but what we're realizing, of course, we're still not making the connections between gay marriage and COVID. I have an article coming out in an anthology where I basically say that gay marriage is one of the leading reasons why we are in this COVID mess in the United States. Because gay marriage is actually, we haven't yet done the math or the analysis, but the gay marriage fight really succeeded in pushing out the fight for universal healthcare in this country. It is a major reason why we don't have universal healthcare. And therefore, consequently, it's a major reason why this country, the richest in the world, has a system that is so broken down that the numbers, you know, are just unfathomable. I don't know, are we at 400,000? I mean, at some point it's such a gigantic number, right? And people in this country are dying. People in this country are going, you know, homeless, are hungry, and so on. But I think that there is a lot to be said for the idea that gay marriage is a cause of that. So we have that political and economic fallout, but we are also, I think, going to suffer in the long term other kinds of fallouts. And so I have no hope. I mean, I'll stop there just to say that I have absolutely no hope or faith in the mainstream gay community, because I think it is completely, it is mobilized by and it is ruled by a rapacious, greedy, racist, sexist mainstream gay community that gives not a crap about anyone else but itself. And it has been the cause of much of the misery that we're enduring in this country.
I mean, and so the person who personifies this perhaps the best is Pete Buttigieg, also someone who our first openly gay candidate for president, right? And so the things you're describing accumulate.
I think he's a second. There was another guy, but no one wants to.
I mean,
about
I guess for. Oh, was I, he open? I, oh okay. Sorry.
No, I apologize. No, I'm sorry.
You know, like this, I mean, this really like a creature that seems to be like created in the lab of homonormativity, yes, in the politics that you're describing. And so, but what one thing that I thought was quite refreshing was that when he announced that he was running for president, the queer left didn't really entertain the idea at all. Like they took straight to Twitter and started dragging him immediately. And I think it was the decades of anti-assimilationist queer activism and the critiques of representational politics that were strong on the queer left, thanks to groups like Against Equality, that sort of prepared us for a person like Pete Buttigieg. So it really wasn't a surprise, I think, to many that the first openly gay candidate, or maybe the second openly gay politician with a shot at the presidency, would appear in the figure of this white, upper middle class, married and monogamous Christian war veteran. And many people pointed this out. And I do think in this regard, the project of Against Equality and others was a success. But now that gay marriage has happened, now that we've lost the fight in many ways, right, against inclusion, where does it leave groups like Against Equality? So what I guess I'm wondering, like, beyond just sort of like endless critique of this injunction to be included and assimilated, what are the demands of what, or what should the demands be of the queer left? What is their political horizon? Was Against Equality a socialist organization? What I guess maybe sometimes this got left out of the the more visible conversations that the queer left was having.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So one of the things that we always try to emphasize, but I think also, yes, you know, got lost in the conversation was that what Against, you know, so Against Equality actually began as an archive. I mean, it was Ryan's idea because he realized that there was no sense of a history of queer radical thought and politics. And he just said, you know, there needs to be a place on the web where we just have an archive of everything that, you know, over the centuries actually of queer radical thought in the sense, I mean, however you apply queer as it were. So it actually began, I guess the point I'm trying to make through that is that it actually began in some ways as a discursive project. We've never been a political group. We've been a group that says thought and discourse and analysis and keeping histories in mind is what's actually important if you're going to affect change, right? So in that sense, our project was also never to, we never thought about how to dismantle, you know, HRC, for instance. That was never our intention. Our point was always to say, we have to keep showing people what the alternatives are, right? So you're right. I think it's because of that, exactly, you know, that sort of decade or so, we just turned 10, a decade or so of queer radical critique and analysis is what has enabled even straight people to look at Pete Buttigieg and say, well, you know, no. You know, so I think there's a way in which discourse works in these interesting subterranean ways. And then suddenly you get Pete Buttigieg and you actually have, for the first time, you actually have some sort of a resistance to that, and which will, I think, continue. But so what is Against Equality now? You know, right now it's a very static entity on the website, and the website occasionally we refill it, for instance, you know, we put new pieces up and so on. But we never saw our intention as being something that could deliberately create havoc in the way that people might imagine, but it's a different kind of discursive response that needs to exist. But repeat your question again, please. I know.
I mean, I guess did Against Equality have, but beside a critique of inclusion, did it have a set of positive demands, like asking?
So our positive demands have always been implicit and sometimes explicit in the pieces that we put up. So for instance, prison abolition. Right? Our demand is, we've always identified, long before it was fashionable to do so, and I'm going to provide this as proof. We published our, this is totally me selling Against Equality. This is the book that right now that exists, but before it existed as an AK Press, book, we published the entire book in these three absolutely adorable tiny little books. Which, because I say so, this is true. They are collector's items. I say so. Anyway, the point being that in all of these, you know, prisons will not protect you, for instance. This is the one about prisons. And this is one where we clearly, every one of the contributors clearly demands prison abolition. And this was in 2000, let me see. There's a date here, 2012. So this is way before it became fashionable. Now everyone's an abolitionist. And this is, of course, not to take away from people like Mariam Kaba and Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who have been doing this work for decades. But in terms of queer politics, right, we were among the first to demand that prisons need to end. We also published the book about Don't Ask to Fight There Was, where we also demanded that we stop thinking about inclusion in the military and instead focus on what kinds of resources trans LGBTQ people would need to survive outside pushing them to join the military just to get healthcare, for instance. So those have always been, so even if we didn't have an explicit sort of, you know, set of demands, our politics have always been explicitly about saying, you know, no to marriage, yes to universal healthcare, right? No to prisons, stop expanding the prison industrial complex through devious means like the hate crimes legislation, that's been so popular. No to the military industrial complex, you know, fight for a world where queers and other people have resources that allow them to live as human beings without having to have promise to have their, you know, brains blown out, for instance, right? And then in terms, and then of course, in terms of other issues like immigration, for instance, the demand has always been, don't ask queer people to get married just to gain entrance into something like citizenship, right? Expand that notion of citizenship and so on. So, and that's, again, this is me. And that's why we have books now, like my friend Karma's book, Queer and Transmigrations. Again, so the critique has always been aligned with a vision of, the demand has always been the vision. Right, and that I think is also what is important to emphasize, is that the critique has been about showing the possibility for a different world, and that's the demand. You know, I think Matilda Bernstein Sycamore's words, right, which always haunt me, which is, our dreams have become so small, and that's our basic demand, is expand our dreams. You know, what is there beyond the prison industrial complex? What would we do without prisons? What can we do without the military? You know, Dean Spade's work is so important for that, for instance, and so on. So that's, yeah.
No, perfect. I mean, I wanted to bring this up because I think so often people understand anti-assimilationist politics to be something that's not much more than making fun of individual gays, right, who want to get married, but it is, you know, it's a movement for prison, right, abolition, abolishing the military, free healthcare, exactly, open borders, and that, exactly, yeah.
Also, I just wanted to emphasize also, if I may, I apologize for, don't intrude if, and apologize, yes, but anyway, sorry, but I do want to emphasize that our policies have also never been anti-assimilationist in that sense. Against equality is different from a lot of other radical queers who keep bringing up anti-assimilation. We actually don't care about the problems of assimilation, because for us, that's not the issue. It's not assimilation that's the problem, it's the larger capitalist structure that's the problem, right? So for instance, with marriage, you know, a lot of people have accused us of saying, well, what if, you know, life and death issues and, or, you know, my partner. And we've always said, if you need to get married, marry. You know, take what you want from the state, take it and run. If that's what gets you into this country, if that's what gets you healthcare. I've had so many straight people and queer people tell me, I got married for healthcare. And I'm like, do it, you know, do it. And maybe you want to get married because you like marriage. I don't know. I don't know why anyone would, but there are people I know, you know, who like being married. Fine. We've never been against that, right? So assimilation was never a problem for us, because focusing on assimilation then, you know, and we'll talk about this later, right? Then becomes, oh, well, do you have radical sex or not? Or are you dressed in a radical fashion, you know, et cetera? Do you have the eyeglasses? Do you have the clothes to prove? You know, so that assimilation argument takes us into territories that we've never really cared about. You know, for us, it's been, what do you have to do to survive? Do what you must. But even as a married person, you can maintain a critique and you can work in your workplaces, in your social lives, against that agenda. You know, you can be married and still say, go up to your HR person and say, you know, this is rubbish. Why are we making people get married for healthcare? You know, you can go up to your, you know, anyway.
Brilliant. No, absolutely. That's exactly it. Before we get into the what you just sort of foreshadowed, quick question is, where's the this like NGO industrial complex going next? So like what can we expect from, what do you think, where does HRC go now that, you know, gay marriage has been achieved? Because these even though NGOs sort of explode and they present themselves as temporary solutions to whatever states can't provide, they're here to stay. And yeah, and they're a big part of the economy. So I guess sort of like, what do you think we can expect to see next? Will there be a focus on domestic politics? Will these campaigns become more international? Yeah.
You know, what's interesting, yes, I think HRC, as you may know, HRC, I can't remember which year this was, but at one point HRC refused to have trans people included in the Equal Right to Work, I think, bill. You know, so it was really explicitly anti-trans at one point. Today, of course, HRC has become trans directors and has a trans policy director, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what HRC is going to do, along with the task force, the mainstream groups are all going to start keep looking around. So for a while there, they were really into queer youth homelessness. Of course, they didn't really give a damn about them, but they took up the issue because that became very much a topic of conversation for a little while. Now it's trans things like trans issues, trans inclusion in the military, but also trans issues in terms of housing, employment, and all of that. So I think what HRT and task force do, they're very mobile. And so capitalism survives because of its mobility, right? Because of its adaptability. So in that sense, I think HRC and task force are mobile and adaptable. My big fear is that they might actually move towards global, international issues. But in a sense, you know, they already have an effect. So for instance, in place, and again, I want to say, you know, all of this is very complicated in the regions themselves, but in India, for instance, you know, there is a sort of an elite gay community, and it tends to be more or less sort of assimilate, you know, HRC light, as it were. And what we're seeing is the growth in the rest of the world of a sort of a human rights industrial complex that looks at gay issues. And unfortunately, you know, Joseph Massad has written about this extensively, right? The Gay International. And that's troubling to me, especially in countries like India, where the economics, where there's so much gap between the haves and the have-nots, right? So that's a problem because you have millions of really poor people who need the resources that NGOs promise them and who might then sign on to some really horrendous policies around gay and lesbian representation, for instance. So that's, I think, very worrying. I was listening to someone the other day from Taiwan who talked about, I guess Taiwan now has legalized gay marriage. And it was all cast as, you know, now that I have gay marriage, and this was someone who presented himself as a queer radical. And he said, well, now that we have gay marriage, I can finally recognize myself as a person. And I just remember thinking, this is it. This is what we've done, right? We've exported the worst aspects of that. So I think they're not struggling per se, but I think that's what they'll probably do is move into that sort of international solidarity campaigning, as it were. And I think domestically, they're just going to keep looking around for bits and pieces to sponge off, really, you know, of work that's being done locally. On the other hand, you know, I would encourage people to look at smaller groups that are, what is interesting to me about radical politics today, like for instance, politics around prison abolition, politics against things like hate crime legislation, is that you no longer have to look for the queer person. Most of these resistance movements are almost entirely personed by queer people. So prison abolition, what a lot of people don't know is that many, 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 many prison abolitionists, like, you know, critical resistance, for instance, the group critical resistance, it's almost entirely queer, right? So what I find interesting is that queer left politics has moved away perhaps from the conventional gay and lesbian organizing issues and has always been part of things like prison abolition. So I find that really interesting. And I think that's also perhaps in a way hopeful.
Sorry, I couldn't unmute myself. Yeah, this is all very interesting. And I think I would like to move a bit to some of the things you already, I think, described very well in the introduction. So like maybe get a bit more into details. Like, I really like the story you tell about the changing of queer politics in the 70s to the present, and also like going really back to this inherited narrative of diminishing homophobia and stuff like that. And I think you have a lot of things to say about what is the effect on focusing on homophobia as like an eternal abstract state against which we are always struggling as queer people, right? And so, there's something in particular I wanted to ask. Once we were having this conversation with Alex, and I thought that maybe you probably have a good intake on this. So when this year, like a 27% of LGBT voters supported Trump, and there's also like the leader of the German AfD has been a lesbian woman since 2017. There's been a huge embrace of the far right by gays in France. So like, we see how there is like this kind of convergence that to some point we can say there's some novelty in it towards the far right movements, at least like wider population of the LGBTQ, not by individuals that are far right or conservatives. And I just wonder how you understand this development, if you want to say a bit more. I think you said already some stuff at the beginning.
Sure. Yes, so exactly, you know, until about the 90s and even I think the aughts, the big cultural and political division was here's the awful far right and here are the poor sad gays and lesbians, and we must take up the cause of the gays and lesbians, etc. And then Pete Buttigieg comes around and that sort of, I think, smashes people's brain and go, wait, what is happening here, right? He is pro-war, he's vile in so many respects, and he's gay. So I think, yes, I think fundamentally what we're beginning to realize, or we should realize, is that first of all, that there are so many different variations of LGBTQ politically. And I think is an important fact that people are going to understand as the years go on and in the best possible ways. I think that complexity, I think what happened at least in this country, till about the aughts, until so recently, it was widely assumed that simply being LGBTQ meant you were a left or at least liberal person, right? And I think what's being exposed now increasingly is, for instance, besides being intensively capitalist, also just the racism of the LGBTQ community, for instance. In Chicago, I can assure you that the mainstream gay community here is intensely racist, to the point of, it's hideously racist. It's so bad that going to the gay and lesbian, to Boys Town, as we used to call it here, is just a traumatic event for those of us who are not white LGBTQ people. So it's that bad in Chicago. And I think people are only now beginning to feel like they're able to call that out. So I think that has come about, and the awareness of that is going to increase. And I think we're going to see more and more evidence that the gay and lesbian community, the mainstream gay and lesbian community, has an enormous amount of economic capital, as in capital, and that it is extremely powerful, and that it is willing to do what it takes to maintain its position of power, right? So, I'm thinking about Pete Buttigieg as one specific example. But I think we have a long way to go before culturally we actually also start to question, for instance, the motivations of HRC or the task force and so on. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
I think part of it, this has added to the things you were already saying at the beginning about how you confront this landscape in which you have experienced historically a far right that has been homophobic in the sense that it attempted to materially eliminate the lives of queer people, and that forced some sort of polarization and addressing their homophobia as kind of the strategies of a queer movement that wants to become visibilized, and that how this has changed with time. So like it leaves us with the question of whether addressing homophobia in itself is politically productive, right?
Yep, right, exactly. And I think the task ahead for us is to say homophobia is just one of the problems, but it's not. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was listening to the news today about the Proud Boys, which is this extreme right wing group in the US, part of, I think, one of the groups that that was involved in the Capitol raid on January 6th, for instance. And that we know is extraordinarily right wing, and everything that you can connect to the right wing sort of resides in the Proud Boys, for instance, right? But there's all of this talk now about white supremacy and why that's a problem and racism is a problem and so on. But it's actually not. I mean, it is a problem, but the white supremacy argument, right, that white supremacy is what is imperiling this country to the largest extent, that's not actually true, because we have structural problems in this country, right, and across the world, which are not born out of white supremacy or the marginalization of various peoples. They're born out of systems that are so depraved that they don't value human life unless that human life can be configured in, can be valued in material ways. So to focus so much on white supremacy in this country is an easy way out, I think, right now for a lot of people, because they can also then keep the focus on Trump. Right? So a lot of people in this, and I'm getting to the point about homophobia in this roundabout way, but just to sort of expand on, you know, the last 4 years, people in this country, you know, the sort of broad left has focused on Trump as the problem. Trump's racism, Trump's, you know, misogyny, and the misogyny and racism of his followers, etc. It allowed them to conveniently forget that everything that Trump did was because the ground had been laid by, for instance, the Obama administration and many others before him, right? So babies in cages, everyone was going on about babies in cages. And there were these photographs circulated of children having been wrenched away from their parents and being placed in cages. And then much to people's, chagrin, it turned out that those photographs of babies in cages were from the Obama administration. Right. So, and the point I'm trying to make there is, I think we are running into the same issue with questions around homophobia, where we, I think, talking about homophobia as intensely as the mainstream gaze in particular would like us to talk, right? Or talking about, okay, let's look at, for instance, I think the best issue to talk about in relation to this is the question of what is happening with trans murders, right? So right now and there's a necessary conversation about the fact that many, many trans people are killed, and not just killed. I mean, there's overkill. You know, Eric Stanley writes about the overkill of the trans party, that they're not just killed, but then they're dismembered, they're disposed of in horrible ways and so on. So it's not so much, so the focus is on the fact that trans people are being killed for who they are, right? So it's transphobia, or it's homophobia of gay people are being killed, but that somehow there's this intense transphobia that leads to the deaths of so many trans people. That is true, but the reason that so many trans people are always are always in danger of such violent, vicious deaths, right? The reason for that is because we have excluded them from all other systems of support. And the reasons for that is because, so for instance, we have these horrendous anti-sex work laws, right? We have systems of housing discrimination, right? So there is no way to ensure, even if on paper we say, well, you cannot discriminate against somebody for sexual or gender identity and so on, it's actually really easy to do that. You can get away with it. We have, in this country, we have no support system for people who are homeless. We have no healthcare system, etc. So what that means is that the average trans person who is not, for instance, Caitlyn Jenner, right? But the average trans person upon coming out immediately is cast out into a terribly dangerous system, which often involves street work and so on. Those are the conditions that leave them vulnerable to extreme hostility and to death, right? But talking constantly as we do right now, right, about transphobia allows us to forget all of that. So now, for instance, there's all of this celebration of the fact that Joe Biden is now letting trans soldiers back into the military, which is actually transphobic. In my mind, that is transphobic because it is essentially saying that we can now deploy this extraordinarily marginalized community of people, you know, in our wars. And we talk about, oh, well, you know, it allows trans people to have access to healthcare and it allows them access to basic resources, to education. Why? why must a trans person in particular sign themselves up for, you know, death, basically, in order to perhaps survive in some way? So as with homophobia, I think transphobia, right, and it has become a way to occlude and forget about the vast systems of exploitation, of marginalization, of deep deathery and violence, really, that trans people are part of, right? So, and that's a lot like what's happening, I think, in this country with this conversation around white supremacy, for instance. You know, of course white supremacy exists. Well, of course, yes, absolutely. But it exists in a country where, you know, if you're not born into, I don't know, the at least the upper middle class, your chances of even having $400 in savings are nil. I mean, this country is a complete failure. But to talk about transphobia, homophobia, white supremacy, all of that also allows us, and then of course it allows, you know, good liberals and lefties to feel good about themselves, you know, by putting up whatever, you know, flags and turning their little profile boxes black on certain days, etc. You know, we have all of that. But the systems of the systems within which LGBTQ people are born into in this country are murderous systems. Murderous, absolutely horrific.
Yeah, it's like kind of makes this game of dematerializing something which at the beginning tried to address the material conditions that produce this exclusion and reduce this to upper, like a cultural phenomenon. And then when building the history of the queer community, if you want to sustain like a historical continuation of ongoing reduction of homophobia, then you have to kind of make up these cultural forms of queer life that are like emerging. And like at the end, if you look at history, you see that this is always changing and it's so contingent. And I wouldn't venture myself to make that claim that we have gone through a progressive stage of reducing homophobia. I understand how this can be politically useful to articulate in a particular campaign to achieve something. And then how do you have to sometimes maybe move away from that and try to like confront the situations or the issues that you're facing in the moment in a different way. And I think that, I mean, what you were explaining is very, very clear in my head about how this actually becomes at the end a completely other discussion about what's going on instead of actually making people question why these people are being murdered, why these people are being excluded. And so there's another thing I wanted to talk about. So you've written about this culture of addressing sexual harm, and as well as this like non-political mobilization of sex among some like radical queers or whatever. And so I understand that your critique for this like non-political sex is a warning about like, it's like warning that some sexual inflated discourses of the lack of political like don't have any political content in itself. So like you say, I have this very radical way of engaging sex, but why is the politics behind that actually? Why are you suggesting? And like your critique of like the culture of sexual harm or the addressing sexual harm constantly is that it reduces some sort of like, it's what you were explaining also now, like reduce a very complex issue to a set of like circumstances beyond control and understanding. And then when it's coupled with trauma politics, it covers itself with some sort of like presumed systemic analysis that actually is not a systemic analysis. So you've mentioned that and you can elaborate more about this if you want. Then apart from that, it doesn't really produce any program or tool for organizing, and it doesn't really produce a critique of capitalism, right, or the material conditions of our existence, let's say. So I think you have some interesting things to say about this, and you can elaborate more as I said before. But I am also interested about something that came up in another conversation we have with Max Fox. And I've been thinking about that, which is related to the idea of in which ways sex is important or what sex has to say for us. So if like sexual harm and trauma politics are not politics, And the sexual transgressiveness is not like transgressive in itself. In which way do you think we can understand sex politically? So what is the political meaning of sex, if there is any? How it's interesting for us.
Right.
And it links in a way to this idea of homophobia that we just discussed, because so it's like not only that the idea of trauma politics demands this kind of constant elaboration of homophobia and the context in which it happens, like this kind of like ambivalent relation of like, in order to be traumatized, there has to be something that is creating this trauma. So like the whole narrative is built there. So moving away from that, like the questions, maybe like what set of questions we can make if we're thinking about sex. Mm. So like, what is really telling us that the far right politicians are worried about this particular form of same sex and not about another one, or these particular cultural forms? Because of course, like within the far right parties, there are people having same sex, there are homosexual people. And like, I presume that they don't have anything in particular about this. I don't know. What do you think about this?
Right. So to unpack some of that, I'll start with saying that one of the women who was arrested during the January 6th, whatever it is in a polyamorous relationship. Laughed out loud because I've been saying for years, you know, your sex does not make you radical. And this is not to say that polyamory makes you, you know, an extreme right-wing person, but it's just proof that, you know, whom you fuck has nothing to do with whether or not you fuck up capitalism, right? And that is the most important thing. So I just wanted to sort of start with that. And you said something about Max Fox and sexual harm. So are you referring to an incident he discussed, or is just a set of ideas?
No, it was just like we were discussing about the way in which sex can tell us something about politics, or in which way we can derive political ideas from sex.
I would say no. So I would say that sexual practice has nothing to do with politics. And that sounds so broad, right? And sort of dismissive. I think there is a tendency on the part of the left to constantly, and I don't know if this is where, you know, you guys were going, but there's a tendency on the part of the left to constantly want to recover sex as somehow liberatory in some way, that some, you know, because I'm so interesting in what I do sexually, surely that is somehow, right, liberatory in other ways. You know, it's not. I'm sorry, but again, you know, the Nazis loved bondage. And we, you know, not to bring up the old cliche, let me tell you what the Nazis did. I don't mean to do it that, you know, but I mean, so, you know, all of the, there's no, I think what we have to investigate is the obsession with locating politics on the plane of the body. That is something I think we have to start to really question and critique. I think we have to admit that, yes, there are ways in which, so for instance, you know, drag, no one wants to talk about drag anymore, but you know, let's talk about drag, right? Drag has been an interesting radicalization of gender politics. And we know this, I think this is, you know, classic queer theory, blah, blah, blah. And yes, that is in some ways connected with destabilizing perhaps the power of the state to surveil certain bodies, right? So gender, for instance, you know, or perhaps even sexual practice, let's say certain sexual practices. So I think on that level, what you do in terms of sexual practice has nothing to do with politics. However, there are forms of sexual practice and sexual life that have been, that are not discussed And that if we were to focus on those, we would see how sex and the body are actually connected to political power regimes. Let us talk about sex offender registries. Let us talk about sex offenders. A few years ago, Florida passed this law that basically gave voting rights to felons. I don't remember the exact date, we can look it up. It was a huge deal, especially for prison abolitionists. A lot of celebration, rightly so, because as you know, again, this country is so mired in such horrible politics that we somehow actually think that, you know, ex-felons don't even deserve, you know, to vote. So that was a big deal. The only people left out of that was sex offenders. It didn't matter if you had been found to not be guilty. And I don't even want to go into the whole who's guilty and who's not and who's an acceptable sexual predator. And there are people on sex offender registries who haven't actually committed acts of sexual violence, but they're still called sex offenders and cast out of society because of the technical definition. I'm not even going to get into that because I don't like these kinds of, I don't like always drawing distinctions between good and bad. I don't like all of that. But let's just talk about the fact that sex offenders were just left out. No one would touch that, right? Now, it's different in Europe, but in the United States, if you are placed on a sex offender registry, whether you're placed there because you actually raped a child or whether you're placed there because you peed in front of a school, I mean, this is the wide range of, this is how ridiculous it is in this country. This is how easy it is to be classified as a sex offender and to be placed on a registry. If you're placed on a sex offender registry in this country, your life is over. Your life is over. Unless you have access to family wealth in the millions, your life is over. You can barely exist. You will probably never find a job. You're not allowed to live in most places. There are all kinds of restrictions about where you can live, et cetera, et cetera. Your life is pretty much over. It's absolutely over. I've written a long article for the Windy City Times about LGBTQ sex offenders and what happens to them, which is, double and triple the horror. So if we're going to talk about sex, if we're going to talk about sexual practices, if we're going to talk about what people do with each other, we need to start interrogating how certain sexual practices or lives or inclinations continue to be not only marginalized, but blighted and to be, certain lives are destroyed. And none of these people who are talking about, how liberatory it is to be in a polyamorous relationship and how liberatory it is to be in a whatever, to perform certain sex. None of them are talking about this issue. And until you talk about that, you cannot talk about sexual politics and liberation in the same way. So prison abolitionists have been completely silent for the most part, except for people like Erica Miners and God bless her, Judith Levine have written about sex offenders and queerness and all those issues. But prison abolitionists have been largely silent about this very critical issue. The number in terms of how many people are on sex offender registry, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but people can look it up. It is massive. And it's been increasing every year. And it is the one, in 1992, I think, it was the last time that NAMLA, the North American Man Boy Love Association, which is the controversial, quote unquote, it's often portrayed as a pedophilia association, et cetera. It was the last time they were allowed to march in gay pride in New York City. That was the last, and then there was a huge furor. People were outraged. And until then, it had been fine for them to be included. What that does is to, anyway, I want this to be more of a conversation about this, but I guess what I'm trying to say, and I tell me if this is making sense, is that when queers and other people talk about sex and fucking and sexual practices, they sort of assume that merely the way you fuck people is somehow in itself about liberation, but they're completely avoiding the ways in which certain kinds of sexual practices or definitions of what counts as sex, right? Certain kinds of all of that actually are very much part of this tyrannical system that brutalizes and erases people's lives. And that is connected, you know, to how capitalism operates, to marginalize certain people and also to create divisions between us. I mean, you can't talk about NAMLA these days. You can't talk about, you know, without being called a pedophile. Go ahead, sorry, Alex.
No, I was just gonna say that, like, I mean, in the same way that the sort of, if we look at what happened to cruising practices and public sex and this, that can tell us something about gentrification.
Thank you.
Sex offender registries can tell us something about, you know, the prison industrial complex. But that doesn't mean that the practice of cruising, that we can derive some sort of ethics or politics from it. Those are two different things. And I don't even know what this also came up with Max. I don't know why this is so controversial. It's a very like just standard Foucauldian move to say talking about sex won't liberate you. You know, that was somehow like the basics of queer theory, yet somehow.
But that's the part of queer theory everyone wanted to ignore. I mean, a lot of people, as you guys know better than I do, but I haven't read my Foucault in far too long and I need to return to him. But as you guys know, right? Foucault, people read him conveniently. they pick and choose parts of Foucault that they want to use, and then they sort of ignore the fundamental questions that he's throwing up about power. Like, what is power? What is the state?
And I recently, I mean, I'm like almost embarrassed about how much Foucault I've read sort of during my time in higher education, but I mean, I spent so much time with Foucault in undergrad and postgrad, and only recently did someone send a piece to me about what Foucault was writing at the time about pedophilia, in line with a lot of sexual liberationists. And of course, a lot of what they said was, you know, would be considered a political faux pas today, to say the least. But I mean, and Max Fox said this as well in our talk with him, if we think about the courage to write about and touch certain topics today in the academy, there's a big gap between what they were sort of, anyway. Sorry, Felix, did you want to jump in? Do you have anything else to say?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think all of you were like just touching upon things that were interesting. Like, I do agree, or like my current position, and I think it's done for a while already, is that whatever sex you do doesn't have anything to do with the way you fuck capitalism, as you were saying, which is really interesting. And it's kind of like, so like my way of approaching the question was also addressed to exactly this idea of either you think that sex is going to give you some sort of ethical directions to the way you were going to emancipate yourself from what already, like from what exactly, we don't know really. Like, there's no such a thing, like, from some sort of eternal abstract will to dominate. But you don't know what will, like, what are the intentions of that will to dominate and control you, where they come from, like, what are the politics behind, what are the political interests, the political configurations that are actually pretending to control you. And then there's another thing in which I was thinking along this, which I've talked to Alex all the time as well, that, and it came like when Alex just said about gentrification and like cruising spaces, for instance. So like, what does it tell us? That places where particular sexual acts are taking place are erased, and why those and not others? What does it tell us about creating some sort of legislations that ban public sex at the same time when housing is increasingly inaccessible for people? So like, what kind of social structures are you gonna fall into? Not the fact that you are engaging in sex with someone that has the same gender or another gender or whatever gender they have, but it's more about, like, that's the way in which sex, in my opinion, becomes something important to question politically in a way. And like, by tracing these changes, maybe you can learn something, not that much about what individual people do with their lives as a form of radical transgression, which I think is interesting, it's fun. It's good to live, like, if you wanna live this way, it's great. Like, I also enjoy that enough, like, but I don't, like, that's the thing, like, what is the politics behind? Mm-hmm. What is the political program behind all the interesting questions we make? So it's kind of like trying to the idea, I guess, is that if you're so interested about this, let's then talk about something else as well, right? So let's take this point of sex that we find it so interesting and go beyond what it's actually telling us.
Right, right.
We might almost say that sex is politicized, but sex doesn't politicize.
Yes, right.
How you have sex isn't very meaningful, but what sex is
absolutely. Yeah, exactly. You know, in Chicago, I used to live in Uptown, which is up north and is now much whiter than it used to be, and near an area called Andersonville, which is really white and very, very gay. And what is interesting is that every time, so there's a place that's Chicago, Uptown, Andersonville, mostly white, gay. And then there's Humboldt Park, which is on the west side, which has been mostly Latino for the most part for many years, right? And a lot of gay men will go to Humboldt Park to score their drugs. You know, they'll slum it. Or sometimes they'll have, you know, if the men from Humboldt Park come up north and they drive in their very particular kinds of cars, et cetera, they're immediately snagged by police, right? As long as gay men can, you know, but the gay men who do drugs inside, and this is not to stigmatize drugs or anything like that, but it's just to make these points, which is to say white gay men can have their Latino drug dealers come up the back stairs and deliver, you know, stuff. That's fine. The cops are not looking at that at all. What they're looking at is the Latino guy in the car driving through Uptown and daring to even be there. I've seen this frequently where the cops will just stop someone for no other reason than, you know, there's a very specific kind of car, there's a kind of person driving it and he's not supposed to be there. Chicago, just for context, for people who don't know, Chicago is an extraordinarily segregated plantation city. It's very, very tight about how it, you know, how it controls who comes in and goes out of certain neighborhoods, et cetera. So there's that whole thing about, you know, sex and politics and recreational activities, right? All of that, and how all of that is bound up with gentrification, et cetera. And I think that's that sort of thing is what we need to be talking about much more rather than, yes, you know, are we having fun or are we being subversive? You know, is this something that's rupturing some ideal respectability? Well, maybe it isn't, maybe it isn't, but that's not really the point. Which is not to say, you know, I've written about queers and friendship and sex, you know, and I've, you know, pointed out, and I think it is important to note that we have, as queer people, we have come up over many, many years with ways of responding to each other and relating to each other outside the usual dyads of, you know, lover, boyfriend, etc. And there's a queerness to our relationships that I think it's important for other people to think about, etc. Sure, all of that is important. But yeah, you know, when push comes to shove, whom you fuck has nothing to do with how you fuck up capitalism. You know, that has to be what we think about. And I think, you know, you brought up trauma as well, Felix, you know, this question of trauma. Trauma has become, again, it's become this cohering element within the queer radical community. And it's really bizarre because now it's as if you don't exist if you don't have a trauma that you can explicate and lay out as a narrative, right? And that trauma narrative of yours precedes your existence in any group, for instance. It's quite strange. And it's, you know, that has to do a lot, you know, with questions around gender, with questions around the legibility of queerness, right? How are queers made legible now is through trauma, you know? But Alex, you look like you were about to say something.
No, sorry, my dad just tried to enter the room. Something that I can't. Sorry. I just wanted to.
No, no worries.
I thought the example of Chicago was, I mean, really, like, it's about property relations. You know, like, this is not, that's, anyway, the final thing that I wanted to jump in with you was about the neoliberal university. You have been sort of scathing in your, and just like honest, you've been real about, you know, what's up at university. And you've basically said what lots of people know is true, but don't sort of dare to say, often because they're affiliated with the university. But my impression over the last year was that the leading voices within academia the people who we sort of look to didn't have much to say during the sort of mass uprisings and Black Lives Matter riots. And I'm not talking about, you know, like, I'm talking about the tenured professors who have like much less at stake than many others, including even politicians. But they were relatively silent, and they didn't come out with the sort of support that we would have hoped for. There was this one afternoon, we were in lockdown, and I was just listening to podcasts while doing the dishes. And I listened to a podcast where, you know, the riots were kicking off in the US and Judith Butler was promoting her book on nonviolence. And I listened to that whole podcast, and then it immediately went over into the next podcast, which was about, oh gosh, what's her name? I think Vicky Osterweil wrote a book in defense of looting, and she's a writer. I don't even think she's affiliated with the university. And the contrast was so stark to me. Right. And I remember thinking, where are our leaders in academia? Where are the, you know, where are our queer leaders that we look up to? Why aren't they saying anything? I wonder if this was your impression what your thoughts on are this, because I know you've been looking at the developments within sort of the corporatization of the university in sort of the long durée.
Right, sure. And the first thing I want to say, because I think a lot of people think that I criticize the university because I want to be part of it, and I'm not. And I just want to be clear to everyone and say that I actually left because I realized that I wasn't able to write, which is why I left, you know, my conventional university job at great risk to myself in ways that I can't go into right now. I still think, I perhaps stupidly and too idealistically, I still think of the university as a place with the potential for, if not radical, at least deeply interesting work, you know. And I always say that my PhD was the best thing I ever did in my life. Honestly, it was, because it just gave me tools that I carry with me in all my work. You know, the reason that I can write pieces about shit and about sexual politics is because I can go into any topic, and I'm able, because of those years of learning how to do research, et cetera, I'm able to do that kind of work and to think in interesting ways, which is not to say that you have to have a PhD to do that. My utopia is a world where the tools that we give people during, you know, a PhD, the duration of studying for a PhD, the tools that we give people should be available to everyone. Right, so regardless of who you are and where you come from. But that's it. So just putting that aside, as far as, you know, who are our queer leaders, I think we just need, I'll give you this, I'm not sure it's an anecdote, but I'll just tell you this, which is that I have my original copy of Eve Sedgwick's Epistemologies, and just published, I think, in 1992, which is when I got it. And over the years, I would read and reread. And for some reason, I always found Sedgwick deeply annoying. This was long before I understood what queer radical politics, you know, before I actually even became really political. And she was, of course, the goddess, right, for all of us. And every year I would read Sedgwick and I would make notes. And it got to the point where I realized I would have to date my comments just so that I would see my own trajectory of thought. And they got angrier and angrier as the years went by. At some point, I just started to say, oh, fuck this shit. You know, so I have my ratty copy somewhere in storage. But the point I'm trying to make is that I think, you know, queer theory in itself has never been politically radical. I think it has been interesting. I do think, you know, gender trouble, although that also derives from what people had already been practicing in life, you know, the idea of disrupting gender norms. Yes, I do think that those texts are deeply interesting. I think these distinctions between, for instance, you know, homosexual versus homonormative versus, you know, homo and homoerotics and all of that. I think that all of that has entered the language. And I think that's interesting and important for us to be thinking in more complicated ways. But queer theory was never radical politically, other than simply asserting the queer as somehow inherently trans, you know, inherently a liberatory figure, and that's just never been true. Judith Butler is, you know, whenever she talks about Palestine, I just start to yawn, because she is such a profound liberal. I mean, her position on Palestine, for instance, is not particularly interesting, I think people are interested because they say, oh, look, here's this prominent gender theorist. She's talking about Palestine. And there was that moment, for instance, when there was this whole kerfuffle around CUNY and Palestine and all of that. And she spoke up and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that was important politically, perhaps, but never been a particularly politically radical person at all. And I think that's true. So I think with what's happening now in terms of queer theory, I think is that it's, you have the collapse of a university system, and you have many people within universities, unless you are at, say, Princeton or Harvard, right? Unless you're absolutely at a place, and that's not, I'm not saying top universities, I'm saying universities with the most amount of money. Unless you're at a place that has that is sitting on mounds and mounds and mounds of money, you are looking at your entire career possibly disappearing tomorrow. There are people who are waking up every month nowadays, finding out that their whole department is being wiped out, especially if you're in ethnic studies, gender women's studies, but even, you know, liberal arts programs are literally being just dismantled. People are literally waking up to hear the news from their chairs that we don't exist as of tomorrow, right? I mean, this is only a slight exaggeration. So what's happened, I think, is that for a lot of people, they're staring into the maws of hell and they have to make themselves relevant. And then combine that with the constant celebritification of discourse in the United States in particular. So then you get people like Marsha Gessen in The New Yorker, you know, who makes cult heroes out of people like Avital Ronell or Judith Butler, right? She writes this long profile of Butler. She wrote about Avital Ronell during that whole fracas at Columbia and so on. And Gessen doesn't really understand academic politics, right? So at one point, for instance, she wrote, Avital Ronell is a star. And my friend wrote to me and said, according to whom? In whose firmament? Like, who has been reading Ronell for years? You know, but I guess my point I'm trying to make is that what's happening is that you have academia in general collapsing, and you have people, particularly in queer theory, now seems interesting 20 years after the fact, to people like Gessen and others who are part of that celebrity making apparatus. For them, queer theory seems really interesting. Oh, look, where has this been? How wonderful. So the New York Magazine does this big profile of Judith Butler, for instance. You know, again, where that work has either stalled or is simply repeating itself within academia, for people outside it who are also looking for clickbait, who are also looking for new celebrities, I think queer theory in particular is providing some of that, right? Some of that material. But, you know, in because we had said, you know, we'd be sort of talking about this, I went online, I think yesterday and today morning, and I was just sort of Googling queer theory syllabi. And it's the same thing that people, like, I remember thinking, A, the texts haven't changed, which is fine, you know, in every course around a certain discipline or whatever you want to call queer theory, there are obviously seminal texts and then there's, you know, but the questions haven't changed in queer theory, right? The questions are the same. What I do find interesting are queer studies. I think the field of queer studies is really vibrant. Shameless plug. For instance, books like my friend Eric Stanley's edited collection, Trapdoor. I don't know if you can, on my screen, it looks mirror, anyway.
I can see it, yeah. I was gonna ask you if you have any shout outs for what people should be reading. I mean, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, you mentioned already.
Trapdoor, my friend and comrade Ryan Conrad is working in Canada currently and doing fantastic work around HIV laws. And by the way, speaking of the body, Felix, body, sexual practice, etc., we haven't spoken about HIV. We haven't spoken about the criminalization of HIV. I always had faith in my Canadian brethren. I thought, well, you know, you're sort of the people we aspire to above us. You've got healthcare, you've got this. But for some reason that I can't quite comprehend, Canada has the worst laws in relation to HIV criminalization. And Ryan's been writing about that. In the US, you know, Michael Johnson's case, which, you know, to his credit, I often disagree with Stephen Thrasher, especially when he was always writing about gay marriage. But to his credit, the journalist in academic Stephen Thrasher is the only person who has been consistently writing about Michael Johnson, who's a Black gay man who was criminalized, well, basically for having slept with white gay men. I mean, that's really what it comes down to with it. So we haven't spoken about the criminalization of HIV. That's a huge issue. Ryan's been doing a lot of excellent research on that. I can send you links to all of that. But, you know, trans issues, transcultural production and the politics of visibility. This is more about queer studies, you know, or Karma Chavez's book, which is about queer and trans migration. And full disclosure, I have an essay in this, but you know, this is about migration politics and queerness, but it's queer studies, it's not queer theory. So it's located in what is actually happening in terms of what's happening with queer bodies trying to make themselves across borders. What are the issues, whether it's gentrification, whether it's international laws, migration, COVID now, et cetera, right? All of that. That is, I think, where the most interesting work is happening. Work around queers and gentrification, for instance, there's a lot of work around that. But queer theory, I think it has been enormously useful. It defined me for many years. I think it's not that we need to dispense with it, but I think it has run its course. I don't know what else you can do now with queer theory, which is why I think, you know, people like Butler have to enter that celebrity industrial complex, as it were.
Fantastic. I don't have any more questions. Felix, do you have something to add?
No. Just wanted to add that, just in case it sounds before that I am like an anti-sex person, I am not at all an anti-sex person.
No.
Just like sometimes when you make these kind of statements, it comes across like you're rapid, like very fast polarized against that. And it's like, no, I don't have anything against it. I love that people enjoy it. And I love that some people can have like certain level of freedom in the way they engage in sex.
Right.
And it's like the fact to say too, and that's it.
Right. And there is, you know, something to be said about certain kinds of sexual practices and the public spheres that they can create, you know. So a friend of mine was telling me when he was reading one of my pieces, I think the one about polyamory, but he said, you know, like I figured where he was, maybe in Paris or somewhere, but he was in this sex club, I think. And he said, you know, we were all standing around watching this guy get fisted, and the two men were complete strangers to each other. And the rest of us were all strangers to each other as well. And at the end of it, there was this very tender moment, you know, where I think it was the fister who perhaps, you know, kissed the fistie very tenderly and then they parted and moved away. And there is something to be said for creating a sexual space that is not defined by the usual, are you married to this person or do you have a relationship with this person to care for them, right? So that moment where two strangers are engaged in the sexual act among other strangers and yet express a tenderness and then part, there is something there, right, for us to think about. Like, what does this say about intimacy and public sphere? Absolutely. At the same time, at the end of the day, long term, right? I mean, those are moments of rupture, I think, that will take us to a better place, yes. But the bigger question for us has to be, right? What are the systems that we are forced to inhabit, you know? And I'm thinking about trans people being forced to join the military, for instance, just to exist, just to live. And I'm thinking about what happened to Chelsea Manning, you know, who came out as trans, and has yet to receive any real support from a lot of the trans veterans. I mean, in fact, they hate her. HRC even at one point came out against her, right? So whose bodies are we willing to accept and whom do we dispense with? Sex offender registries, you know, HIV among African Americans, among Black men, for instance, right? Those are the bodies that are criminalized. HIV among white gay men, it's all, you know, we must accept you and so on. Whose bodies do we, in terms of the body, you know, whose body do we accept and integrate and whose bodies do we expel and marginalize?
Fantastic. I think, Felix, we'll link all the books you mentioned in the description. And also, I just finally got around to reading Conflict Is Not an Abuse by Sarah Schulman, and she has a fantastic chapter on Canada and HIV criminalization in Canada that sort of, yeah, contests a lot of the romantic visions that I think Americans have about the Canadian healthcare system and this and that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This was so much fun. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for this. This has been amazing. This has been great to be able to talk about all these issues at length. Yes.
Also, sagen wir mal, diese Grundidee von Kommunismus, ne? Die ist ja voll geil. 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 Die ist ja voll geil.
Однако русские коммунисты выстоят, есть бенгальские трудности, так и не справились.